We would like to send out a special thanks to the fun and challenging Best Fiends for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Best Fiends is the binge-worthy mobile puzzle game. Download Best Fiends for free from the App Store or Google Play. Plus, earn even more with $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Enjoy the show. May 26th, 1991. Grand Rapids, Michigan. 28-year-old Gorin Page Jr. is discovered to be missing from his room at the Cascade Foster Care Home, a residential treatment center for individuals with autism. Since a man matching Gorin's description is seen hitchhiking on a nearby interstate, it is theorized that he escaped from the home in order to travel to Florida to see his family. While there are reported eyewitness sightings of Gorin, and a baseball card collection believed to belong to him is found in the weeks following his disappearance, Gorin continues to remain a missing person. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering two famous missing persons cases which were featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the 1991 disappearance of Gorin Page Jr. and the 1993 disappearance of Christy Krebs. I've received multiple requests to cover both these cases, and I've decided to combine them together into one episode because there are numerous similarities between them, including the fact that they are considered to be two of the saddest and most heartbreaking missing persons cases ever featured on the show. Gorin Page Jr., who went by the nickname Gordy, was a young man who went through a number of personal struggles in his life until he was finally diagnosed with autism during his late 20s. Of course, this was a time period when the world still had a limited knowledge of autism, so Gordy's parents decided to place him in a group home before he suddenly escaped one night, and he has not been seen since. Christy Krebs was a young woman who had to be hospitalized after suffering a trauma-related breakdown following an incident where her car caught fire. 3 years later, when it appeared that she had finally gotten her life in order again, Christy seemed to suffer a relapse after another incident in which she drove her car into the woods and got stuck in the mud. While the abandoned vehicle would be discovered, Christy herself was nowhere to be found, and the evidence suggested that she may have suffered another breakdown and wandered away from the scene. Indeed, a number of eyewitnesses would later report having picked up Christy hitchhiking and said that she appeared to be living in a fantasy world and had no memory of who she was. Now, at the time the Unsolved Mysteries episodes about these stories originally aired, there was hope that Gordy and Christy might still be alive somewhere and just did not have the capability to contact their families, but 3 decades have now passed and they are both still missing persons. So in this episode, I'm going to start off by discussing Gordy's disappearance before I move on to Christy's, and then I will provide my theories and analysis for both these cases. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the disappearance of Gorin Page Jr. Our first story begins in Grand Rapids, Michigan in 1991. Our first victim is 28-year-old Gordon Thomas Page Jr., who goes by the nickname Gordy. At this point, Gordy is residing at the Cascade Foster Care Home, a group home located in Cascade Township, which is part of the Grand Rapids metropolitan area. The home is a treatment center for autistic individuals, and Gordy became a resident after being diagnosed with autism several months earlier. At around midnight on May the 26th, an orderly was performing a routine bed check and discovered that Gordy was not in his room. 2 days earlier, Gordy had broken one of the windows, and since it couldn't immediately be fixed, a piece of cardboard was taped in its place. It appeared that Gordy had removed the cardboard and slipped out the window, and when a search of the grounds failed to turn him up, the staff contacted the Kent County Sheriff's Office and reported Gordy missing. When he left the group home, Gordy was not carrying any identification or money, as well as the medication that he needed to take in order to prevent seizures. He was believed to be dressed in only jeans and a t-shirt, and it was unclear if Gordy even had any shoes on when he left. It was theorized that Gordy may have escaped in order to go visit his parents, who were living in Florida at that time. Gordy was originally born in Detroit to his father, Gordon Page Sr., and his mother, Linda Page, and he also had two younger brothers named Lance and Todd. During Gordy's childhood, the Page family moved around a few times, as he attended elementary school in Athens, Ohio, and high school in Wisconsin. Ever since he was a child, everyone sensed that there was something different about Gordy, as he would often speak to himself and just sit alone and look around without moving. At age 6, doctors told Gordy's parents that he had some brain dysfunction, but they didn't think it would seriously affect his intellectual growth. While Gordy had difficulties in some areas, such as simple addition and subtraction, he was exceptionally gifted in other areas and had an outstanding memory when it came to certain topics. For example, he amassed a large collection of around 25,000 to 30,000 baseball cards and could accurately memorize the names and statistics for all the players on these cards. While Gordy was able to maintain friendships in elementary school, social interaction seemed to become a lot more difficult for him as he entered junior high and high school. Gordy became aware that he was slower than many of the other kids and had trouble keeping up in class, and was bothered by the fact that he had to be placed in a special education program. Throughout his childhood, Gordy had loved playing basketball and was particularly skilled at making free throws, but as he entered his teen years, he grew to hate the game and once told his family, quote, "I cannot play basketball in front of all these people." In spite of his struggles, Gordy did manage to graduate high school in 1981, and after his parents helped him apply for a job at a local grocery store, he wound up getting hired. But even though Gordy was a hard worker and seemed happy at his job, he had issues expressing himself and communicating with customers. Even though Gordy's parents worked hard to help him improve these skills, his employer eventually decided to let him go. During this time period, the Page family would meet with a number of different social workers to try to figure out what was different about Gordy, and one of them recommended that he be placed in a group home. However, since Gordy could not enter this home without being stabilized on medication, the Pages consulted with a doctor who prescribed him Ritalin and Valium. Unfortunately, these medications seemed to change Gordy's personality, as they almost rendered him catatonic and caused him great torment. Gordy would claim that he had visions of cats scratching his skin, and his parents would sometimes find him shrieking and crumpled on the floor in the middle of the night. After nearly 5 months of this, the Pages consulted with another doctor, who recommended that his medication be adjusted, and Gordy's condition seemed to improve. By 1989, Gordon Sr. had sold the auto dealership his family owned and got a new job as an automotive consultant in Tampa, Florida. At this point, Gordy's brother Todd was attending college in Texas, and his other brother Lance was a medical researcher at the University of South Florida, prompting Gordy to say to him, quote, "When you become a doctor, maybe you can give me a new brain." When Gordy was finally accepted into a group home in Grand Rapids, Gordon Sr. and Linda decided to move to Tampa, though they would return to visit him whenever they could. Well, on November the 29th of that year, a disastrous event occurred when a workman showed up at the group home and left his truck parked in the driveway with the keys in the ignition and the engine still running. At the time, Gordy was heavily medicated, and even though he had been taught how to drive a car, he never had a license. Gordy felt the sudden urge to climb into the unoccupied truck and drive it through the neighborhood before he wound up getting into a hit-and-run accident with another motorist, who saw Gordy climb out of the truck and walk away from the scene. Later that day, he was found at a nearby elementary school where he appeared to be attempting to teach a class. The next time he spoke to his parents, Gordy told them he took the truck because he wanted to drive to Texas to see his brother Todd. As a result of this episode, Gordy was placed in the psychiatric unit of Kent Oaks Hospital, where he was evaluated by a social worker named Bill Arnold. Since none of the medication Gordy had been prescribed seemed to have any effect on him, Arnold concluded that he did not have schizophrenia. By November of 1990, after nearly 1 year of therapy, Arnold finally had a new diagnosis. Gordy had high-functioning autism. He concluded that Gordy had average intelligence and was a very honest person who cared about the people around him, but he just had a hard time understanding abstract things. As a result, Gordy was taken off his medication and recommended for treatment at the Cascade Foster Care Home, which housed autistic adults. However, one of the conditions for enrolling Gordy there was that he could not receive any visitors for the first 2 months in order to help him grow accustomed to his new environment. The Pages reluctantly agreed to the request and placed Gordy in the group home in March of 1991 before returning to Florida. On May the 22nd, after the two-month window had passed, Gordon Sr. traveled back to Grand Rapids to visit his son. Gordy tried to invite his father into a work training program he was involved in, but the group home's counselors advised Gordon Sr. to leave immediately and return a few months later, after Gordy adapted to the new program. When the visit concluded, Gordy and his father shared an emotional goodbye in the parking lot before Gordon Sr. climbed into his van. But as Gordy was being escorted to the entrance by the orderlies, he suddenly ran to the van and attempted to open the locked passenger side door. Gordon Sr. reluctantly allowed the orderlies to escort Gordy away and take him back into the group home before he left. But tragically, this would turn out to be the last time he ever saw his son. Indeed, it was only 4 days after this incident when Gordy was discovered to be missing from his room. After a missing persons investigation was launched, a fireman came forward to report that approximately 1 hour after Gordy disappeared, he had been driving along Interstate 96 near Grand Rapids and saw a young man hitchhiking who appeared to match Gordy's description. Over the next few months, there would be numerous reported sightings of Gordy, including one from a police officer who believed he saw him on a highway near Lansing, over 60 miles away, but he wound up losing him. 6 weeks after Gordy went missing, a collection of baseball cards was discovered underneath an overpass on Interstate 96, near separate ramps which led to Detroit and Chicago. Of course, Gordy owned a large collection of baseball cards, but what stood out here is that three of the cards were found separated from the rest of the collection, and they just happened to feature three of Gordy's favorite players, future Hall of Famers Robin Yount, Paul Molitor, and Eddie Murray. Following his son's disappearance, Gordon Page Sr. took frequent trips from Florida back to Grand Rapids and traveled thousands of miles around the country searching for Gordy. He printed and distributed over 100,000 missing persons flyers, which offered a $15,000 reward for information leading to Gordy's safe return. The Pages included their current phone number on the flyer and instructions for Gordy to contact them, as well as this message, quote, "Gordon, you will not go back to that group home, and you will not be punished or locked up. Gordon, you are not a criminal," end quote. Gordon Sr. spent over $100,000 of his own money and maxed out his credit cards during the search for his son, which also took a major toll on his health. Gordy's story would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in October of 1994, and in an interview she gave to the Tampa Tribune, Linda Page said that she would not watch the episode because she felt it would be too painful seeing Gordy's face on television. The Pages were hoping that Gordy might still be alive somewhere and had possibly been checked into a hospital as an unidentified John Doe, but while the episode generated a number of new tips, they failed to lead to a resolution. In January of 2001, Gordy's maternal grandmother passed away, and when the Page family traveled to Michigan to attend her funeral, they placed a classified ad in the Grand Rapids Press in hopes that Gordy might see it and show up at the funeral to reunite with them. Gordon Sr. also stated, quote, "I know I'll see him in heaven, but I hope to see him before that," end quote. Well, sadly, Gordon Sr. passed away in January of 2018 at the age of 81, without ever receiving conclusive answers about what happened to his son. So after more than 30 years, Gordon Page Jr. continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So now let's move on to our second story. Our next story begins in Mendocino County, California in 1993. Our second victim is 22-year-old Christy Krebs, who lives with her parents, Bob and Susan Krebs, and two younger brothers in Fort Bragg, a small town of just over 6,000 located on the coast of the Pacific Ocean. Christy is an aspiring chef who is currently working two separate jobs at a pizza parlor called Round Table Pizza, as well as a local Burger King. On the evening of August 9th, Christy showed up for her shift at Round Table Pizza and appeared to be in very high spirits, so much so that her manager believed she was unusually happy and hyper. The manager decided to ask Christy why she was in such a good mood, and she simply answered, quote, "It's not what you think." After Christy's shift came to an end, she left in a red Toyota Tercel at around 10 p.m. and said she was going straight home, but unfortunately, she never arrived. Christy's parents would soon report her missing to the Fort Bragg Police Department, and at around 2 p.m. on August the 10th, a ranger would discover Christy's abandoned Tercel in a remote corner of the Mendocino Woodlands State Park. The location was about 7 miles south of Fort Bragg, and the vehicle had gotten stuck in some mud and blew out two of its tires. There was a jack on the front left tire, the car radio had been ripped out, and there were minute traces of blood on the dashboard and front seat. Christy's wallet, driver's license, bra, and underwear were inside the vehicle, and some wet work clothing, which had the Round Table Pizza logo on it, was neatly folded in the back seat. In addition, there were also shredded identification papers in the car, and a couple of torn-up photographs were scattered nearby. Christy herself was not at the scene, but the park ranger was able to use her identification to track down her parents and inform them about what happened. A massive search effort was launched for Christy, but no trace of her could be found anywhere in the woods. When the authorities spoke to Bob and Susan Krebs, they were surprised to learn that the discovery of Christy's abandoned vehicle was almost an exact carbon copy of another incident she'd experienced 3 years earlier. On April the 30th, 1990, Christy was employed at another local restaurant and once again seemed unusually euphoric and happy when she showed up to work her shift that night. When her shift came to an end, Christy left to drive home, but instead she drove around aimlessly for hours before she wound up on a remote country road in a redwood forest. Once again, her car got stuck in some mud, which prompted her to rev the engine, but in an unusual freak occurrence, this caused the vehicle to overheat and catch fire. The flames completely engulfed the car and destroyed its interior, and while Christy managed to climb out and was not physically harmed, the incident seemed to trigger some sort of mental breakdown. The following morning, railway workers spotted Christy wandering along the Skunk train tracks at a spot around 13 miles outside of Fort Bragg. She appeared to be dazed and disoriented, and since one of the railway workers recognized Christy, he went to phone her parents, who soon arrived to pick Christy up. While Bob and Susan were driving Christy home, they noticed that she was acting very strangely by chanting and patting herself, so they decided to take her to a hospital. After Christy was examined, she was admitted to the hospital for treatment, and even though it was initially suspected that she might be on drugs, testing found no traces of drugs in her system. Over the course of the next week, Christy was pretty much completely incoherent, and for over a month, she claimed she did not recognize her family or friends and could not even remember who she was. It turned out that Christy had recently developed an unhealthy obsession with a male co-worker who was married, and during her final shift, she had been sharing fantasies about an imaginary wedding and having children with this man. Even though they had no basis in reality, these fantasies were likely the cause of the unusual euphoria Christy had been experiencing, and when her car later got stuck in the woods and caught fire, the incident may have caused her to snap. Christy's doctors would diagnose her as having experienced a psychotic, trauma-related break, which caused memory loss and confusion. Christy would start undergoing therapy and drug treatment, and seemed to make solid progress, as she eventually told everyone that her memories had returned. After 6 months of treatment, where she checked in and out of the hospital 4 times, Christy finally returned home for good. Christy's occupational therapist suggested that she return to work, but to avoid potential strain, it was recommended that she only work part-time for around 20 hours per week. Indeed, Christy soon found employment at Round Table Pizza again, and made so much progress with her recovery that she decided to take on her second job at Burger King. In fact, she turned out to be such a solid employee for them that she kept picking up additional shifts and would sometimes work a combined total of 10 to 12 hours per day at both jobs. Christy also spent a lot of her spare time exercising at a health club in order to keep her weight down, but the side effect is that she wound up getting a lot less sleep. Bob and Susan were concerned about whether Christy would be able to keep up her manic pace, but she assured them that she could handle it. However, when Christy's abandoned her cell was discovered in Mendocino Woodland State Park, at a spot which was only 7 miles away from where her previous incident had occurred, her parents immediately had flashbacks and became concerned that she had suffered another psychotic, trauma-related break and was now wandering around somewhere with no memory of who she was. It turned out that shortly after she left her final shift at Round Table Pizza, a park ranger had spotted Christy sitting inside her vehicle in the parking lot of a public beach in McCarracher State Park, located just north of Fort Bragg. The ranger said he told Christy that the lot was scheduled to close in 15 minutes and asked if she was okay, but Christy assured him that she was and just wanted to sit there for a while to relax. It seemed like after Christy and the ranger parted ways, she decided to drive back through Fort Bragg and head south. At some point, she likely turned onto a small country road into Mendocino Woodland State Park before she veered onto a twisting dirt road and eventually wound up at the spot where the car got stuck in the mud. Since the vehicle was next to a shallow creek bed, it's possible that Christy fell into the water at some point, which would explain why her wet work clothes were found inside the tercel. Indeed, since some gym clothes Christy often carried around with her could not be found in the vehicle or at her home, she likely changed into them before she tore up her identification and the photograph she was carrying and wandered away from the scene. Indeed, there would soon be a number of eyewitness sightings of Christy throughout California. In the days following her disappearance, multiple eyewitnesses reported seeing her hitchhiking on both Highway 1 and Highway 20. They said that she appeared to be disoriented and was dressed in a white t-shirt and pink shorts, which matched the description of Christy's missing gym clothes. On a rainy day in March of 1994, a woman claimed she saw Christy walking along Highway 101 in Humboldt County, over 100 miles north of Fort Bragg. Since the woman's daughter had been a former classmate of Christy's, she immediately recognized her and pulled over, but when she called out Christy's name, the young woman took off into the woods. On June the 30th of that year, a highway worker named Mike Case picked up a young female hitchhiker near Visalia, about 300 miles south from where Christy disappeared. Case believed the woman appeared to be disoriented and may have been on drugs, and he noticed two slash marks on her wrist. When Case asked what happened, she said that she had a breakdown and mentioned having a boyfriend who was, quote-unquote, not very nice. After a 90-minute drive, Case dropped the woman off at an intersection near the town of Hanford, but 1 week later, he read about Christy's disappearance in a magazine and noticed a number of similarities. He took the initiative to get in touch with the Krebs family, who sent him photographs of Christy, and Case became convinced she was the same woman he had given a ride to. When Case shared details about his conversations with the hitchhiker, Christy's parents believed that a number of things she said matched Christy's personality, as she mentioned a boyfriend who seemed fictional, shared her love of the ocean, and talked about a desire to visit San Jose, where Christy had relatives. While around the same time as Mike Case's sighting, the Krebses were contacted by a Utah woman named Alicia Larson, who was certain that she had also picked up Christy hitchhiking in Salt Lake City in the days following her disappearance in August of 1993. According to Larson, when this young woman climbed into her car, she said, quote, "You're looking at the happiest girl in the world," a phrase which was often used by Christy. She also told Larson her name was Chris, which was Christy's nickname, and she said that she had recently fallen in love with a trucker and was planning to meet him in Amarillo, Texas to get married. The woman claimed that her boyfriend was being chased by police and did not want to return home because it might put her parents at risk. After they got married, she and her husband were planning to hide out in some caves located by the ocean near her hometown. Of course, Larson thought the young woman seemed delusional and dropped her off near a McDonald's in Park City. But as the woman climbed out of the car, she said, quote, "Burger King is better," and of course, Burger King just happened to be one of Christy's former places of employment. It would not be until several months later when Larson saw Christy's missing persons flyer at a gas station and became convinced she was the hitchhiker she had picked up. When Larson spoke to Bob and Susan Krebs and recalled the hitchhiker's clothing, they were impressed by how accurately she described Christie's missing gym clothes. Even though it was reported that Christie might be dressed in a white t-shirt and pink shorts, Larson was able to provide specific details about the shirt which had not been released publicly, including a pink emblem and some neon blue and neon yellow colors. The Krebses would submit Christie's story to Unsolved Mysteries, who agreed to produce a segment about her disappearance, which aired in February of 1995, and she was also featured on an episode of America's Most Wanted. While these segments produced a number of tips and sightings, which placed Christie in different sections of the United States, none of them panned out. Christie's family held out hope that if she had lost her memory again and developed amnesia, she may have been checked into a long-term care facility as a Jane Doe because no one could figure out who she was. Even though Bob and Susan's sons would go on to have a total of 5 grandchildren, they have always felt a major void in their lives from Christie's disappearance, and as far as I can tell, they are still living in Fort Bragg today on the chance that their daughter might turn up alive again. But unfortunately, after 3 decades, there's still no conclusive answers about what actually happened to Christie Krebs. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, I would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Best Fiends. I would also like to reminisce about an incident which took place a few weeks ago, where I was hanging out with friends, and we experienced an unexpected power outage which lasted for a great deal of time. We were just killing time drinking and chatting, when they suddenly noticed that I seemed to vanish without a trace, but rest assured, the trail did not go cold. No, I was just sneaking off to get in some more quality time with Best Fiends, a free-to-download mobile puzzle game containing thousands of exciting levels for new adventures and challenges every time you play. Best Fiends is definitely one of the best ways to de-stress when I'm not writing, researching, and recording this podcast, and also while experiencing a lengthy power outage. In fact, one of its best features is that it has the option for offline play, so you'll never be stranded without fun, even if you lose your internet connection. I made a couple of podcast-related trips these past few months, and Best Fiends has been a great way to pass the time while traveling. I've been playing Best Fiends for over 2.5 years now, and I'm currently approaching the milestone of level 4500. Since new levels are added to the game all the time, Best Fiends always keeps things fresh, and there's never any danger of it going stale. So download Best Fiends for free from the App Store or Google Play. Plus, earn even more with $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. So like I mentioned in the intro, the disappearances of Gordon Page Jr. and Christie Krebs have always been two of my more highly requested Unsolved Mysteries cases since the inception of this podcast, though they are often cited as two of the show's most heartbreaking stories. What made them stand out from many other missing persons cases is that there was no evidence that foul play had taken place, and there was a decent chance that both victims might still be out there alive somewhere. Perhaps Gordy and Christie were living as homeless transients, or they were placed in a hospital or a care facility by people who were unable to determine their true identities because they either had trouble communicating or legitimately could not remember who they were. Back when these Unsolved Mysteries segments originally aired, they had only been missing for a few years, and there were reported sightings of them, so you could always hope that the additional exposure on national television would lead to them being found. But sadly, that has not turned out to be the case. Another thing that both these victims have in common is that Gordy and Christie seem to have incredibly nice and supportive parents who obviously had to deal with a number of obstacles while raising them, but never stopped searching for their children or spreading awareness about their disappearances. I was incredibly sad when I heard that Gordon Page Sr. passed away a few years ago because he came across as one of the kindest and most genuine people you'd ever want to meet, and he clearly had nothing but unconditional love for his son. There's one particularly touching moment during the Unsolved Mystery segment where they show actual home video footage of Gordy while his father is speaking off camera trying to coach him about how to show off his winning smile and say phrases like "you're welcome" so he can improve his communication skills with the customers at the grocery store where he worked. And I always choke up during Gordon Sr.'s interview, where he recollects Gordy's pure happiness and excitement after finding out he had gotten the job there. Gordy just had the misfortune of being born decades before anyone had a real awareness about what autism was, which is why he wasn't officially diagnosed until he was 27 years old. I mean, from today's perspective, hearing that Gordy was misdiagnosed as being schizophrenic and simultaneously prescribed Ritalin and Valium seems like a recipe for disaster, but his family pretty much had to learn as they went along. As a result, they ended up making some decisions which they would come to regret, but definitely felt like the right thing to do at the time. Gordy's disappearance is actually not the first missing persons case about an autistic individual which featured on Unsolved Mysteries. A few years before this one, they actually produced a brief segment about the disappearance of 21-year-old Oded Gordon, who lived at a group farm for autistic young adults in Greenfield, New Hampshire. On May the 12th, 1989, Oded just seemed to wander away from the farm, and dogs tracked his scent along a nearby road for 3 miles until they lost it, suggesting that he may have hitched a ride and climbed into a vehicle. Sadly, much like Gordon Page Jr., Oded Gordon has never been found and is still a missing person to this day. Since the Unsolved Mysteries segment about Oded was only 3 minutes long, it did not delve much into his background, whereas they provided a very detailed look at Gordy's years of struggles. Like many people from my generation, my personal introduction to the concept of autism was the hit 1988 movie Rain Man, in which Dustin Hoffman delivered an Academy Award-winning performance as an autistic adult named Raymond Babbitt. In fact, a lot of the original media coverage of Gordy's disappearance made direct comparisons to the film, and one trait that Gordy shared with the character of Raymond was a large baseball card collection and an ability to memorize all the names and statistics for the players. And while we're on the subject of famous actors playing autistic individuals, the actor who was cast to portray Gordy during the Unsolved Mysteries reenactments was none other than Doug Jones, who was an unknown at the time, but has since gone on to bigger things, and currently has over 170 film and TV credits to his name. If you don't immediately recognize Jones from his face, that's understandable, because he's best known for playing non-human characters under heavy prosthetic makeup. He's a particular favorite of director Guillermo del Toro, who cast Jones as Abe Sapien in the Hellboy movies, the Pale Man in Pan's Labyrinth, and the Amphibian Man in the Academy Award-winning The Shape of Water. Jones is a very talented individual, and I would rank his portrayal of Gordy as one of the best acting performances on Unsolved Mysteries. If you want to get the waterworks going, just watch the reenactment where Gordon Sr. climbs into his van at the group home, and Gordy tries to forcefully open the passenger side door because he doesn't want his father leaving without him. That moment is especially heartbreaking when you know it's the last time Gordon Sr. ever saw his son, and he always said that in retrospect, he wishes that he had let Gordy into the van and taken him back to Florida with him. If you search through online comments or discussions about this case, you'll see that the pages have received a lot of unjust criticism for the decision to move to Florida while Gordy was placed in this new group home in Michigan. But you have to remember that Gordy went missing only 6 months after his official autism diagnosis, so once again, his family was pretty much learning as they went along. The mental health professional said it was a good idea to keep Gordy separated from his parents for a while so he could adjust to his new surroundings, and I'm sure that no one ever envisioned something like this happening. So in retrospect, it seems like Gordy's final interaction with his father may have been what compelled him to escape from the group home, as it's been theorized that he was attempting to go see his family, even though a trip from Grand Rapids to Tampa is over 1,200 miles. After all, when Gordy drove off from his previous group home and the workman's truck a year and a half earlier, he said he was planning to go to Texas to see his brother. The Unsolved Mysteries segment didn't mention that Gordy had broken a window in his room 2 days beforehand, which was never repaired, so it's possible that having to witness his father leave him put him on edge. There were a number of reported sightings of Gordy after he went missing, and while we have no idea if any of them were legitimate, it is compelling that someone matching his description was seen hitchhiking on Interstate 96 only about an hour after he was discovered to be missing. Even though Gordy's autism caused issues with his ability to communicate, he was still high-functioning and could perform basic tasks, so he was probably aware of how the concept of hitchhiking worked and may have been hoping he could use this as his method to travel to Florida. But if Gordy did manage to hitch a ride, the big question is whether he would have been capable of communicating where he wanted to go. Interestingly enough, shortly after the Unsolved Mysteries segment aired, investigators received a tip from a family friend from Athens, Ohio, which is where the Pages had lived during the 1970s. This person said that another friend of theirs had seen Gordy walking with a crutch and carrying a small bag while crossing the street near a car dealership the Pages had owned during the time they lived there. While I am skeptical that the witness actually did see Gordy, he had worked at this dealership when he was a teenager, so if Gordy had trouble locating his family, perhaps he gravitated to a place from his past that was familiar to him. At the time, the best case scenario for Gordy is that he crossed paths with someone who became concerned enough about his behavior that they contacted the authorities. We know that Gordy left his identification behind at the group home, so if he couldn't convey who he was, he may have been placed into a long-term care facility as a John Doe. This was the early 1990s, so it's not hard to imagine the authorities being unable to put two and two together and figure out that Gordy was a missing person whose family was looking for him. If this is what happened, then it would be nice to think that Gordy is still alive and being taken care of somewhere at the age of 59, but there are two details about this case which leave me concerned that he is no longer with us. The first concerning detail is that when he escaped the group home, Gordy left behind medication he needed to take for seizures, and during the earliest news coverage of his disappearance, his father flat out stated that if he didn't take this medication soon, he could die. Even if Gordy was found and placed in a facility, it's unlikely that he would have been able to tell anyone about this medication, so if he suffered a seizure, they may not have known how to properly treat him. And if he suffered a seizure in public and died somewhere, it's possible that even if his body was found, the authorities would have been unable to identify him and he was registered as a John Doe. The second concerning detail is the discovery of a baseball card collection underneath an overpass 6 weeks after Gordy went missing. The overpass was located on Interstate 96, where Gordy had last been seen hitchhiking, and while none of the sources have made it clear if baseball cards were missing from Gordy's room at the group home, there is a decent chance that this collection belonged to him. It's been reported that the cards for three of Gordy's favorite players, Paul Molitor, Robin Yount, and Eddie Murray, were separated from the rest of the collection, and it definitely makes sense that Paul Molitor and Robin Yount would be among Gordy's favorites, because he had previously lived in Wisconsin, and they were both star players for the Milwaukee Brewers during that time period. But if Gordy left those cards behind, I'm not sure if that bodes very well for him. Autistic people can become very attached to certain possessions and suffer meltdowns if they lose them or become separated from these items, and from what I heard about Gordy, he likely would have been devastated if he was separated from his baseball cards. This is what makes me wonder if Gordy might have been abducted from that location against his will by someone who did him harm. Unfortunately, Gordy's condition would have made him very susceptible and vulnerable to a predator, though I should reiterate that this is only an assumption on my part, and no direct evidence has ever been found to suggest that Gordy was the victim of foul play. But even if Gordy lived as a homeless transient for a while, would he have had the necessary skills to survive on the streets for very long? I think what separates Gordy's story from the Christie Krebs case is that even though there have been sightings of him, there haven't been any accounts from eyewitnesses who said they directly interacted with him. And that is a bit troubling, since Gordy definitely sounds like someone you would remember if you ever crossed paths with him. It's possible that Gordy was already deceased by the time the Unsolved Mysteries segment aired in 1994, but even so, if his remains are out there somewhere, it would be nice if DNA testing could conclusively identify them and finally provide answers for his family. So now we'll move on to a more thorough discussion about Christie Krebs' disappearance. Christie's story is pretty unique as far as missing persons cases go, because there was a previous incident from 3 years earlier that practically provided a frame of reference for how she went missing the second time around. When Christie's car caught fire in 1990 and she suffered a psychotic, trauma-related break, it's probably a good stroke of luck that she was seen by a railway worker who personally knew her parents and could call them to pick her up. If not, who knows how long Christie may have continued wandering in her disoriented state. She may have wound up vanishing without a trace back then, leaving us with even less insight into what might have happened to her. When Christie's abandoned car was discovered in a wooded area in 1993, I think there was hope that history would repeat itself and she would be found wandering around somewhere within a relatively short amount of time. But this never happened, and the two possibilities are that Christy either died of exposure in the woods and her remains were never found, or she managed to hitchhike out of the area before anyone started looking for her. We certainly can't rule out the first possibility, because even though there was an extensive search effort for Christy, it's very easy to miss human bodies when you're dealing with the wilderness, so for all we know, Christy's skeletal remains could still be somewhere in the Mendocino Woodland State Park to this day. However, even though eyewitnesses and missing persons cases are mistaken all the time, the sightings of Christy hitchhiking contained enough specific details about her that I am inclined to think they're fairly credible, so I do believe she made it out of the woods. But before we talk more about that, we have to explore the circumstances of how Christy wound up in this situation to begin with. Much like with Gordon Pace Jr., one of the issues is that these events took place during a time period when there was less of an understanding about mental health issues. During Christy's original stay in the hospital, doctors believed she had experienced a psychotic trauma-related break, but for all we know, she may have also been suffering from some other form of mental illness which was never diagnosed or properly treated. It's been reported that prior to her first breakdown, Christy had developed an obsession with a married coworker, and during her final shift at work, she was in a euphoric state of mind and having fantasies about getting married and having children with this man. The circumstances of Christy's last shift before her second breakdown sound virtually identical, as her manager described her as being unusually happy and hyper, only this time, she didn't share any details about why she felt this way, only stating, quote, "It's not what you think." Well, we really have no idea what was going on in Christy's mind at that point, only that instead of going home following her shift, she decided to drive through Fort Bragg and stop at the parking lot for McCarracher State Park. After Christy had her conversation with the park ranger and the lot closed for the night, Christy inexplicably decided to drive through Fort Bragg again and head south before she wound up in Mendocino Woodlands State Park. This is pretty much exactly what happened to her 3 years earlier, as she went from being in a euphoric mood at work to driving into remote wooded areas for reasons that only made sense to her. In both cases, it's been speculated that Christy's issues with her vehicle caused her to experience a significant crash, as she may have been in such a state of euphoria that these unexpected complications were too much for her to handle and she suffered a complete breakdown. After the second incident, Christy's identification and some photographs she was carrying were found torn up at the scene, and during his Unsolved Mysteries interview, Bob Krebs theorized that the whole situation proved so traumatic for her that she wanted to destroy her past and get away from it. We'll talk more about this momentarily, but this situation provides a tie-in to the eyewitness sighting provided by Alicia Larson, who claimed she picked up Christy hitchhiking in Utah days later. Christy presented this scenario where she was traveling to Amarillo, Texas to get married to a trucker, and claimed that she had to avoid making contact with her parents because she and her boyfriend needed to hide from the police. She even specifically stated that she did not want to speak to the police because she, quote-unquote, could not tell the good ones from the bad ones. Since Christy had been sharing fantasies about an imaginary wedding with her coworker during her final shift prior to her breakdown in 1990, I have to wonder if she had built up a similar fantasy about this truck driver this time around, which is why she was so unusually happy. Perhaps Christy's decision to tear up her identification and photos could have been an element of the same fantasy, where she believed she needed to start over because she was hiding from the police. Of course, the key difference is that this whole scenario is nothing more than an assumption, since Christy never told any of her friends, family, or coworkers about what was going on with her. And while we know that this married coworker of Christy's actually existed, there's nothing to indicate that she ever crossed paths with any truck drivers from Texas. Once again, since Christy was never officially diagnosed with anything, I'm not going to assume that she was suffering from some sort of untreated mental illness, but clearly, something was going on in her mind. It's been reported that traces of blood were found inside the vehicle, which gave off the initial impression of a foul play situation, but it sounds like it was a pretty minute amount, as perhaps Christy suffered a minor cut while trying to get her car out of the mud, or change her tire, or removing the radio. The missing car radio is definitely the strangest detail about the whole scene, since Christy left so many other items behind, but it's worth noting that back then, many cars were equipped with portable radios which you could remove and take with you if you were paranoid about them being stolen. If this is what happened, I'm not sure why Christy would have been compelled to bring the radio with her, but it may have only made sense to her in her own mind. But of course, since the vehicle was not found until 2 p.m. the following day, the other explanation is that an unknown third party came across it after Christy already left and decided to take advantage of the situation by stealing the radio themselves. One issue is that the Toyota Tercel was not properly preserved as a crime scene. As you recall, when the park ranger who discovered the car found Christy's identification, he decided to contact her parents, and they were the ones who actually took the initiative of arranging for the Tercel to be towed out of the woods. At that point, I think the Krebses were hoping that Christy had simply wandered off and would soon be found safely, so they never considered the possibility of leaving the vehicle for the police to perform a forensic examination. As far as the foul play scenario goes, investigators did briefly look into the possibility that convicted murderer Richard Allen Davis might have been involved in Christy's disappearance. On October the 1st of that year, less than 3 months after Christy went missing, Davis abducted and murdered 12-year-old Polly Klass during a slumber party at her home in Petaluma, located over 130 miles southeast of Mendocino County. Davis was later convicted of the crime and is currently on death row, but even though there were unconfirmed reports placing him in the Fort Bragg area around the time of Christy's disappearance, no evidence has ever linked Davis to this case. Indeed, I am inclined to believe that if Christy did become the victim of foul play, it occurred some time after she made it out of the woods. Now, another unique aspect of this case is that the clothes Christy was last seen wearing were found inside her abandoned vehicle, and while it's assumed that she fell into the creek and decided to change into her gym clothes, we can't say that with 100% certainty. Yet some of the witnesses who saw Christy hitchhiking on Highway 1 and Highway 20 right after her disappearance reported that she was dressed in a white t-shirt and pink shorts, which matched the description of her gym clothes, even though I do not believe that information had been released publicly at that point. Also, if you look at any photographs of Christy, you'll notice that she has a very distinct-looking smile which prominently showcases her gums, and a number of the witnesses who said they picked her up hitchhiking described that exact same smile. The two most prominent eyewitnesses in this case are Alicia Larson, who said she picked up Christy in Utah in the days following her disappearance, and Mike Case, who reported picking her up near Visalia, California in June of 1994. Larson described Christy as wearing pink shorts, a detail which is already mentioned in news accounts by the time Larson came forward. But what's most interesting is that Larson accurately described the emblem and colors on Christy's t-shirt, details which were not public knowledge at that point. Given that this was only a few days after Christy went missing, it would make sense that she would still be wearing the same gym clothes at that point, and the way the hitchhiker described herself as the quote-unquote happiest girl in the world and shared a fantastical scenario about marrying a trucker in Texas does mirror Christy's behavior during her final shifts before both of her breakdowns. For all we know, this trucker did not even exist, but if Christy wanted to travel from Mendocino County to Amarillo, she could do so by hitchhiking east on Interstate 80, which is where Larson picked her up, and it would take her through Utah before she eventually headed southeast into Texas. Now, Mike Case's sighting of Christy took place nearly 1 year later, which meant that if it really was her, she would have had to travel back to California. It's interesting how she was described as having slash marks on her wrist and said they were the result of a breakdown and a boyfriend who was, quote-unquote, not very nice. So I wonder if this can be taken as a sign that Christy's relationship with the trucker, whether it was real or an imaginary fantasy in her own mind, just did not work out. But would Christy have been capable of traveling through the country and surviving on her own as a transient for 10 months? Well, even though Case provided enough details to suggest that the female hitchhiker may have been Christy, they weren't quite as specific as the details provided by Alicia Larson. So it's possible that Case was mistaken, and the young woman he picked up was not actually Christy. But I do think that Larson's account is one of the more credible sightings I've ever seen in a missing persons case, and there's a decent chance she really did give Christy a ride. But if the woman in Utah was Christy, the big question is, what happened to her afterward? Well, the worst case scenario is that Christy hitched a ride with the wrong person who subsequently did her harm and disposed of her body. For all we know, she may be an unidentified decedent buried in a pauper's grave somewhere. But the best case scenario, which I also presented in the Goren Page Jr. case, is that Christy may have been picked up by the authorities somewhere. Since she would not have been carrying any identification and may have completely forgotten who she was, she could have been placed in a long-term care facility as a Jane Doe. For all we know, maybe she might still be there today at the age of 51, but no one has ever put two and two together and figured out her identity. Another possibility that Christie's parents have brought up during interviews is that if she does remember who she is, she may have made contact with a mental health professional at some point and disclosed details of her personal life, but the professional was unable to make contact with her family due to doctor-patient confidentiality. The odds of both Christie Krebs and Goren Page Jr. both still being alive after all these years are slim, but not completely impossible, and they do have a better chance of being found alive than most missing persons. But even if they are no longer with us, their family still deserve to have answers. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Goren Page Jr., please contact the Kent County Sheriff's Office at 616-632-6100. That's 616-632-6100. And if you have any information on the disappearance of Christie Krebs, please contact the Fort Bragg Police Department at 707-961-2800. That's 707-961-2800. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about an infamous case from Unsolved Mysteries, the disappearance of Anne Sigmund, who became a wanted fugitive after the murder of her estranged husband, Charlie Sigmund, and has not been seen in 35 years. In addition, I've dropped an exclusive bonus episode for my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another classic case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1987 murder of Don Smith. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Stephen M., Gene N., and Michael M. Thank you all so much for your support. I'm also pleased to announce that later this summer, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Weston Park Central Hotel in Dallas, Texas, from August the 27th until the 28th. Myself and many other prominent true crime podcasts will be in attendance, and there will be a bunch of panel sessions, discussions, and live episodes, so in order to purchase tickets, please visit the website truecrimepodcastfestival.com. That's truecrimepodcastfestival.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶